This Week in Virology, the podcast about viruses, the kind that make you sick. This Week in Virology, episode number 108, recorded on November 18th, 2010. Hi, everybody. I'm Vincent Racaniello, and it's time to talk about viruses. And as usual, we have a great crew lined up for you, starting in the forests of Western Massachusetts, where there's Alan Dove.
Yep, good to be here.
In the forests.
Yes, good to be here in the forests and good to be around on TWIV.
Good job you have there. You can just sit in the forest and write and record.
Yeah, absolutely.
Very nice. Moving down the coast, where the weather is probably better than it is here in New York City, we would find Rich Condit in North Central Florida. Hey, Rich.
Hi, everybody. 72 degrees, clear blue skies.
Bah.
And we also we have someone here in my office who was at one time in Gainesville, and it's the returning Professor Saul Silverstein. Welcome back, Saul.
Always good to return.
You remember your days in Gainesville?
Very, very, very little.
Is that
when were you in Gainesville?
1968 to 1971.
Was this a PhD?
Yeah.
Wow.
Who did you work with?
Dan Billen, who was a research professor in actually radiation biology, although I was in the Department of Microbiology.
You know that name, Rich?
No. That was a while ago. Have you been back?
Twice. So once when Ken Burns was chair and once when Dick Moyer was chair.
Okay.
That's Ken Burns, the researcher, not the filmmaker.
Absolutely. Right. Well, I don't know that.
We have a very diverse audience. I just don't want to confuse anybody.
The Ken Burns effect. Well, we have our, in science, we have a Ken Burns effect. No, nobody knows what that is. Do you know what the Ken Burns effect is of the movie guy?
It's when I know what that is in video. Yeah.
Right. When you have he put a picture up and he kind of pans across it.
Right.
So he originally did that, I think, for a Civil War movie that he made where he put a lot of pictures together. He didn't have a lot of video from the Civil War. And he zooms in and pans. And now if you go to iPhoto and do a slideshow, it's called the Ken Burns effect.
Huh.
But Ken Burns, the scientist, is B-E-R-N-S.
Yes.
Okay. Anyway, we digress, as we always do.
As usual.
We have a couple of very cool stories today, and one of them is the reason we have Saul here. Not that we need any excuse to have you here. You can come anytime.
It's a long journey.
Yeah, right next door. But before we do, I just wanted to mention, I don't think we ever discussed the results of our poll on how much TWIV do you want. Is that correct, gentlemen? Did we not discuss that?
I don't recall discussing it on the show.
All right. So some time ago we asked you, how much TWIV do you want, every week or every other week? So the results are so far 282 responses, which is only about 3% of our listeners, but that's the way it goes. 69% wanted every week and 31% every other week. So I guess we'll stay with every week for now. Even though
works for me.
Yeah.
Good with me.
If you don't want to listen every week, you know, you can just skip.
Yeah.
Or you have a back catalog. Some people listen to 90 a month, I understand.
Jeez.
Which is amazing. Anyway, I'm going to put a link to that poll. There are a lot of good comments there about the show and the length and so forth. So check them out. And thanks to everyone who participated. And now let's move to our first story, which actually was prompted by an email last week. From Sue, who had asked us about the tree recombinase. So we decided to do this story today. It's a science paper from 2007 entitled HIV-1 Proviral DNA Excision Using an Evolved Recombinase. This is extremely interesting and something that I had missed, and we'll talk about that in a bit. But basically, the problem is you have great antivirals to treat HIV, but you always have cells containing integrated proviral DNA. And apparently, these are long-lived populations, so they never die. And so you always have this DNA integrated somewhere in your body, and you can't get rid of it. So you have to take drugs your whole life. So wouldn't it be good if you could get rid of the proviral DNA? So that's the idea of this.
And in fact, that's the holy grail of HIV antiviral therapy, because if you could drain that reservoir,
you'd have a cure.
You'd have a cure.
You wouldn't have to give people drugs their whole life, right?
Well, there is a cure for those that are lucky enough to be able to get a bone marrow transplant with CCR5 negative cells, and that amazingly worked, although you, of course, don't deplete that reservoir in those people. You just limit the subsequent infection.
Yeah. So you provide a lot of cells that cannot be infected.
Right. Yeah. The real curiosity is, given the fact that we know that it has a neuronal component, why don't those cells get infected? Or do they, and we just haven't looked that far enough?
There is NeuroAIDS. It does transit to the brain.
Right. And so in those patients where they have swapped out the CD34 positive cells and replace them with CD34 positive, CCR5 mm-hmm. negative, so that the virus cannot attach and infect, they still have cells that can be infected in the body because you haven't exchanged those cells out. So the story probably isn't finished yet, but it nevertheless is very intriguing.
So this approach was done just to deal with that problem, getting rid of the proviral DNA, which could apply to any retroviral infection. It could be HIV, HTLV1, XMRV, if that turns out to be an issue, as we've discussed.
Or other murine-like leukemia viruses, if that turns out to be an issue.
Yes, or whatever.
Whatever. Yes. I'm sure in the future, well after we're gone, there will be other human retroviruses, and this could be used for it. Although, it might be difficult, but let's talk about it. This involves what are known as site-specific recombinases. These are enzymes that can cut DNA in a linear sequence and in a sequence-specific way and remove it. And there's the most famous that we know of is called a Cre recombinase, which is from a bacteriophage. And the Cre recombinase is an enzyme that recognizes a sequence called the LOX, L-O-X, which is a relatively short sequence. And if you put a LOX sequence, say, on both sides of a gene, you can cut it out with the Cre recombinase. Fair so far, everyone?
Fair so far. Yep.
So this has gotten widespread use in genetics and molecular biology because you can make mice, and at a certain time, you can excise a sequence by just adding the recombinase or turning it on. So it's very powerful. So what they wanted to do here was to make this Cre recombinase able to recognize a sequence in the proviral DNA of HIV.
And right. So the trick is that Cre normally recognizes this very specific LOX sequence.
Right. Not the LTRs
of HIV.
Right. So they got to train it to recognize another sequence.
Right. So in fact, when you're using the transgenic approach, you have to first put LOX pieces. You have to flank the gene with LOX or FLOX it, and then you can excise it with Cre at a defined point.
Yeah, there you go. FLOXed DNAs is something you'll hear at many seminars. It just means flanking your sequence with LOX so that the Cre will pull it out.
Which has nothing to do with salmon.
Or bagels.
Yeah. Or teeth.
There we go.
And if everyone remembers our basic virology, retrovirology, when these retroviruses integrate a DNA copy of their genome into the chromosomal DNA, it is flanked by two LTRs. It's a repeated sequence. So if you could train Cre to recognize that LTR, you could cut out the proviral DNA in theory.
Which is, in fact, what Cre evolved to do in the first place on bacteriophages, right?
Actually, in the I looked up the P1 situation and learned some stuff that I was not aware of, and that is P1's really interesting because it is a lysogenic bacteriophage, but it doesn't lysogenize in the fashion that we're used to thinking about with lambda, where it actually integrates into the chromosome. It actually forms an episome, a circular piece of DNA that exists separate from the chromosome, so it's more like herpes, in fact. and maintains itself as an episome. And the Cree is a backup system for circularizing the DNA when it enters the cell. It must be, I didn't look this up in detail, but it must be, must enter as linear and with two lock sites. And if you had a linear molecule with two lock sites and acted on it with Cree, that would circularize it.
Mm-hmm.
And it also helps maintain it as a monomer episome. If in the process of replicating you create a dimer, that would have two lock sites, and if you resolve those, you'll get two monomer circles. So it works a little differently than its function in the P1 is a little different than what I anticipated, which would be to pop it in and out of the chromosome.
Right. Okay.
Right.
That's good. Good to know that.
I love the fact that we're taking old phage proteins and using them to treat
yes.
another virus infection in this century. It's really weird.
Well, this is why basic research matters.
Yeah.
Well,
this is the power of recycling.
Yes.
You get an opportunity to think about using something again. And we do it all the time.
Yeah. The whole idea that someone who was working on Cree and P1 thought, I wonder if this would work in mammalian cells, and did it. And now it's a huge part of biology research. This ability to do this has answered so many other questions.
And as Alan pointed out, the first person to ever work on Cree and LOX, I don't know who that might have been, but that was probably way before HIV or any of this stuff. They were just curious.
Right.
As to how this might work. Basic research.
So the moral is you have to just do things that you're interested in, because if you only work on what you think is a problem, you're going to miss stuff like this.
Right.
Anyway, enough of the proselytizing. So the problem is to evolve Cree. And this is the cool part of this paper, the evolution. And they basically use a strategy where they use an error-prone polymerase for polymerase chain reaction to make lots of copies of the Cree recombinase DNA. And a lot of those have mutations in them. And then from that pool, select out ones that can cleave the HIV LTR. So they found a particular HIV LTR that had some homology with the LOX sequence, and they started with that. And they actually put two of those sequences on a plasmid with the Cree gene and then asked for the Cree to excise that sequence, and they designed an assay that would select for plasmids that had been cut. The interesting thing was they couldn't use the entire LTR of HIV. They had to break it into four pieces. And then when they did that, each of the four pieces could be cut by mutant Crees. And they did many, many cycles, and then after each cycle, they would break up the Cree plasmids and shuffle them, and then do another selection with a slightly longer HIV LTR, and then finally with the long one. So they think they did something like 125 individual selections in the end to get a Cree, which they call Tree, which is able to cut the HIV LTR. I think in the end they analyzed 50 individual recombinases for specificity. So they cloned out individual ones and showed that one could cut this LTR. And it turns out to have 19 amino acid changes compared with the wild type Cree.
That's pretty significant.
I mean, it's amazing. They had to use these intermediate sequences that weren't Cree and weren't LTR,
right?
Because the original Cree wouldn't cleave the LTR at all. And they figured they had to have something that would, with a little bit of activity. So they kind of used intermediate sequences,
right?
Four different variants. And they would get enzymes that would have a little bit of activity on each of these sort of hybrid sequences, part LTR, part Cree. And then the shuffling process allows them to combine the domains of the protein at random.
The shuffling is the genius part of this,
yeah.
This
yeah.
approach. The fact that you can just do it blind and can continue to select, because you have this the markers in them.
Well, I thought the selection was really cool, too, because they've got the candidate recombinase on the same plasmid with the target site that they're interested in. Mm. So if you stick that, when you do the transformation, a single bug will pick up a single plasmid. And if so, that particular bug will make the candidate protein and also contain the plasmid with the target site. And if that protein can cleave the target, it reduces the size of the plasmid. You can tell that with a simple PCR reaction. So you can take a pool of these things and do the PCR and see if any of the small plasmids are present. It's genius. It's really beautiful.
Yeah, it's a really, really clever approach.
I think a lot of work also.
Oh, huge.
Yeah.
I can imagine the many times it didn't work and they went back and said, all right, what do we do now?
Well, I would have talked myself out of this before I even started. Because the LTR sequence that it ultimately targets like is so different than the LOX site. It doesn't even have any of the symmetry or anything like that. It's cleaving an asymmetric sequence. Ordinarily, this enzyme cleaves a symmetric sequence. I would have said, well, you can't do it, but they did.
Yeah, this must have been laughed out of several rooms when people were proposing it.
Well, I would think that the genius of it in attempting just to do this is where this is just such an interesting mm-hmm. paper. Of course, they realize immediately that there are considerable obstacles to moving forward with this, and the fact, of course, is that the LTRs are heterogeneous, and you can't evolve. I guess you could evolve a molecule. After all, they have this Provenge treatment for prostate cancer, where they're taking patient cells and making individual antigen-reactive immune cells, putting them back in. So you could probably do this, and it'd be a lot cheaper than doing that kind of a treatment. But you'd have to look at all of the different integrated copies.
Yeah, you probably have many different ones,
and,
right?
You know, just the natural evolution of the virus in the host is going to change.
Yeah, that's
right. And if you built an enzyme that had enough wiggle room to allow for that, you'd have the danger of it taking out things that you don't want.
Oh, yeah, but you know what? You lose a few genes here and there. It's no different than when you get old.
So those are two of the very important points. Yeah,
they acknowledge. Yeah. At the end here, they say, we accept that this approach is unlikely to be of immediate therapeutic use and that considerable obstacles would need to be overcome before an engineered recombinase could be practically used in any clinical setting.
Yes, this is peer-reviewed.
Right.
So you think it wasn't there in the original manuscript,
well,
Rich?
that was my reaction. And if it was, great.
It says here the most important among these is that the enzyme would need to be safe without side effects. Well, you could test that in animals and eventually in people, but the real key is the specificity. I think it could be safe, but it might not hit all the proviruses in one person because there's enough variation.
You know, Saul's comment is certainly legitimate in terms of the individual. That your genes are getting mutated all the time, but if you go and do this and it starts knocking things out in the germline, then you might have some more serious problems.
Well, the real question is, where do you deliver it? And probably the best place, again, is to reconstituted marrow, because what you want to do is prevent subsequent infections and then perhaps have the ability. I don't know how you treat the cells that are present in the body that are dormant.
Right.
How you get whatever your targeting vehicle is to that site. Mm-hmm. And we don't know all of those sites,
that's
for sure.
Right.
And you've got to, theoretically, you've got to hit every cell that has the virus, because you always have an opportunity for the virus to awaken.
Right.
And
so
if it's hiding out in the CNS, then you've got a really serious drug delivery problem.
Well,
right, so the obvious thing is that you do it ex vivo, right? You'd take bone marrow cells, maybe even from the patient, treat them in vitro, in a test tube, if you like, and expand them, and then basically do a bone marrow transplant with that. But chances are there's other hideouts for the virus in the patient. So
right. Well, the other thing is that you have to develop a vector that's going to be efficiently
it's going to deliver the recombinase.
Right.
Is that hard to do?
It's not that hard. I mean, we now have good lentivirus-based vectors that prevent spread and activation of adjacent genes and things like that, that can deliver a gene product. And it, they've been used successfully in a bunch of tests, both for hemoglobinopathies and for some of the immunosuppressed alleles, things that, that loss of a particular gene will lead to immunosuppression.
Yeah, they do. There's a separate paper where they actually, this is a 2007 paper, and then all of a sudden this year there's a new article that just popped up that you found, Rich, a review article.
Yes.
So they say they want to, yeah, they want to purify peripheral CD34 positive cells, stem cells, hematopoietic stem cells, transduce these with a vector producing the tree, and then put them back, and then do multiple rounds of that. And they say that may, you know, reconstitute the people's immune system. But you're right, you still don't get rid of those.
You always
cells.
Have, yeah.
On the other hand, if those cells are dormant, and you can maybe even figure out why they're dormant, you might just be able to keep them that way.
Or, good luck.
It would be a long shot. As people age, a lot of things start happening. But if you could even get this to the point where people would need no drug treatment for several years, it might be an improvement over the current standard of care.
Well, it feels to me kind of like a liver transplant in a hepatitis C patient.
Not a good idea. Yeah.
Well, they do it anyway.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah. Sure, because it gives people some time, but still, it's not a cure.
So I guess the problem is you have to. My understanding is we don't even know this latent reservoir entirely.
Right. That's my understanding.
And if we don't know
it exists because the virus can come back.
But if you don't know it.
We know that there are lymphocytes in nodes that are quiescent.
Right.
And the other end of this story, of course, is the fact that regardless of how efficient your transduction process is, it's not 100%. So you're always going to throw out cells that are susceptible to infection or might be. And just how much of the marrow you're going to reconstitute, which means that you have some percentage, unless you're going to lethally irradiate.
I don't think they want to do that.
No. You're going to have some percentage of cells that remain susceptible to infection. So it's a great idea. It's sort of phase one, if you will, or slightly behind that. And it's going to move forward with probably in many different ways, because you begin to think about how you would generate cells from which you could remove bad genes, if you would.
Yeah.
So it's a prelude to where we go in terms of genetic engineering.
And it could also produce some other cool laboratory tools. If Cre is this malleable, maybe you can massage it to take out genes in a site-specific manner without having to flox them first. Just a thought.
Mm-hmm. So this is going to evolve along with the whole field, basically. And so at some point in the very distant future, it could be used in some iteration. But at the moment, there are lots of problems.
None of these caveats should take away from the basic technology and the findings and the engineering that they've done.
Right. It is an outstanding piece of science.
The evolution of the enzyme is amazing. And we haven't discussed, I want to discuss this figure towards the end where they show that the enzyme that they've made will actually remove proviral DNA from cells that contain a provirus.
Right.
And there's this wonderful micrograph where they've created cells that have a provirus in them, and they can stain them with DAPI to stain DNA and stain also for the HIV gag protein. So you see cells that have a blue nucleus and green in the cytoplasm showing that they have HIV, and then they treat them with the Cre recombinase, which they deliver, I think, by transfection. Oh, yeah, they make stably transfected lines. And over a period of 12 weeks, slowly but surely, the number of green cells decreases to the point where they're gone. Mm-hmm. So, and they got a bunch of other data that supports the notion that that's actually excised the provirus. So it works in cells, in culture. Okay. So, but that's cool.
Yeah.
Yeah. That's an important part, that it will actually work. Because if it didn't work in cells on a provirus, then there'd be no going forward, right, at least with these data. but there are other obstacles. No, it's a beautiful piece of work, but it was worth discussing because all these issues come up.
So, well, you want to stimulate people to think about these problems, and the more we do that, the more opportunity there is for people to address them and
absolutely
create novel ways of researching problems that are we think are intractable at this point, but probably not.
Shouldn't say never, I think. You never know what's going to happen. Now, I had missed this paper. Had you seen it, Saul? Had you heard of it?
It's 4 years ago. I can't even. I'm lucky I can remember what happened last week.
So last week I said I had missed this. So in the meanwhile, we got a letter from Zephyr, who said, I've been a listener since April 2009. Like many others, I quickly caught up with all the episodes. I haven't missed one. I really enjoy listening to it. It combines an invaluable source of information and knowledge about virology, extending to more general subjects on science and research with a highly entertaining format, dynamic discussion, something I felt missing during my undergraduate years. I also appreciate many of the recommendations you've given. What moved me to write this letter is that in TWIV 107, Dr. Racaniello seemed to regret having overlooked for more than 2 years the news about the development of a new recombinase that can specifically recognize and excise from the host genome the HIV-LTR flanking sequences. That overlook must have been a quirk of fate, since the topic had already been around the program in the past. In episode 66, another listener asked about the possibility of excising HIV in a letter read during the program. The question made me remind of the article published in Science I had read not long ago. That same week, I wrote a brief description of the work to TWIV, and it says it's the only comment I've ever written to TWIV, so I couldn't forget it. So he had commented way back on TWIV 66, and he put references to the paper that we discussed today. So I had obviously forgotten about that. And so I apologize, Zephyr, and thank you for bringing it up so quickly. And there you go. We have talked about it today.
Yes.
And he makes this very interesting point. Since I first read that article, I firmly believe that the development of new enzymes and other proteins by means of some directed evolution strategy will eventually become a powerful tool in research and bioengineering. I've also heard from the use of similar directed evolution strategy in the development of new tRNA, aminoacyl tRNA synthetase pairs that have been successfully expressed in bacterial and eukaryotic cell systems. As a result, these cells can incorporate nascent peptide chains, new unnatural amino acids encoded by either a particularly barely used stop codon or one or even more tetrads, specific sequences of four nucleotides, specifically recognized by those evolved tRNAs. This new unnatural amino acid can be used to develop enzymes capable of catalyzing new types of reactions never handled by enzymes before to specifically label proteins in vivo and in the study of the three-dimensional structure of proteins as site-specific NMR landmarks. So that's, yeah, this is in fact true. You can do this kind of evolution to make tRNAs that will recognize four bases rather than three, and that's amazing. You make totally new proteins.
Yeah, and there are actually companies that have built businesses around directed evolution approaches to make enzymes that are industrially useful.
Hmm. So thanks, Zephyr, and mea culpa. But I had forgotten it, you know. The year goes by, you forget things. Yep. So that's that. The second story that we wanted to do today was suggested by a colleague of Rich's, right?
Yes, Rolf Rennie.
Rolf Rennie.
One of our herpes virologists.
And this is a science paper, and the title is Downregulation of a Host MicroRNA by a Herpes Virus Cimeri Non-Coding RNA. And this is why Saul's here, because herpes virus Cimeri, and I figured it's a herpes virus, he would know about it, but it turns out he used to work on this virus. So tell us about Cimeri. What a great name.
Well, Cimeri and Atellus, its nearest neighbor, if you will, are two primate viruses found in New World monkeys. And like other herpes viruses, they have the ability to lytically infect their host and also to latently infect them. And one of the interesting features of this virus family is that they transformed T cells. Mm. And they were not transforming cells from the native animal, but from closely related species. And I can't remember exactly which one is which because it's 40 years ago.
It's a squirrel monkey that's the native animal. I looked some of this up.
Yeah, so one is Aotus and one is something else.
Right.
It says it can transform marmoset
right.
T cells.
Right.
So is that a non-natural host?
That's a non-natural host.
Because this is a classic situation where in the natural host, it infects, causes latency, and no disease. It's in equilibrium with the natural host.
How did they pick up this virus? Does anyone know?
I'm trying to remember now. It was first...
In a zoo, maybe?
I don't know.
Okay. So in a natural host, it's fine. It's not pathogenic.
Right.
But in the not a natural host, it causes leukemia and lymphoma.
Right. And the greatest interest in the virus has come recently where it's been used to transform and immortalize human T cells. So it's a reagent for doing that.
Right. Why is that useful?
Well, there are people who want monoclonal lines of T cells, and this is a way of propagating them and developing them. And it's a great tool because they're immortalized and you can go through and transform populations and select antigen-specific cells or things that are recognizing specific peptides.
So why did you work on this virus? What was the interest?
Well, I was a coward. when I left Bernard Roisman's lab in 1974... I thought it would be a great idea if I could take some of the science that I had developed in his lab to look at gene regulation and apply it to another virus, and one which there was a clear incidence of virus infection and development of carcinogenesis. And I thought that this was a great opportunity. Little did I realize how difficult the virus was to work with at the time, and you'll have to recall that we didn't or couldn't use at that point enzymes to cleave DNA. So the whole idea of mutating specific restriction enzyme fragments and recombining virus was not even on the horizon for another couple of years. And we thought we would just manipulate the virus genome by genetic, by mutation and then select for variants. But unfortunately, the titers were low enough so that it was just very, very difficult to do. And I got sidetracked with a few other things and ended up leaving that field rather abruptly. In other words, my NIH studies, my NIH officer said to me, "You seem to have changed what you're working on." And I asked him, "Is that bad?"
What did he say?
Well, you know, you'll have to write us a report about what you're doing, but they let me by.
You should. That's the whole point.
Yep, you have to know, as I said, you got to know when to fold them.
I mean, after all, you did find interesting things.
We did interesting stuff in the interim, I think so.
Yes, and you can go back to TWIV-17 and find out about that.
And you managed to survive competing with Roisman anyway.
Yeah, you know, that was the better part of it. It was much more fun to have a great competitor who was also a colleague. And as long as you don't eat your young, there's some hope.
So the Cimeria does not infect people normally, right?
Not normally. You don't see it.
But if you take cells from people, you can transform them.
Yes. In fact, if you try and grow Cimeria in most human cells, it doesn't grow very well.
Mm-hmm.
We used to grow it in either owl monkey kidney cells or Vero cells, both primate origin.
So in this paper, in the very beginning, it says, in transformed marmoset T cells, the most abundant viral transcripts are seven small non-coding RNAs called HSUSRs, H-Cimeria-U-rich RNAs. Unfortunate abbreviation, but here we have it. And so this paper is all about RNA interference, right?
Absolutely.
Which I don't think we've talked about really at all, have we, on Twitter?
Yeah, we have. We've talked about... we had mostly in emails and stuff like that. We've addressed some of this stuff. I remember an email where somebody explained how this was first discovered because it was so visual by people trying to enhance the pigment in petunias.
That's right.
And they transformed in a pigment gene, and instead of enhancing the pigment, it bleached it out.
That's right. That's okay. Right.
Those are the original observations.
Yeah.
Yeah. So RNA interference, wow, RNA interference is an amazing field. Basically, how small RNAs can manipulate gene expression. And we've learned that there are many, many ways in all sorts of plants and animals and worms that this can be done.
What's cool to me about the whole RNAi and microRNA story is that here we were, you know, we'd figured out most of the major stuff in molecular biology, and then someone comes along and finds an entirely new department of gene regulation.
Yeah, exactly. Department is a good name for it.
Because it's huge. Absolutely. Huge proportion of the genome is regulated by these microRNAs, and nobody knew about them before.
And we thought it was all breakdown product.
Yeah, and this is like in the past 10 years that we've figured this out.
You can't make your RNA properly. You get all these small things. You know?
It was always there.
So we thought there was this DNA, and we got mRNA, tRNAs, and ribosomal RNAs, and that's it. And now we know there's this whole family of small stuff, the microRNAs, the siRNAs, and I think also the piRNAs is the latest, right? Which are all very small, less than 100 bases, right, for the most part. Which can manipulate the expression of a variety of genes, and they're important for development, for infection and immunity. Viruses have them. Viruses antagonize them. And that's what this paper is concerned with. This one is dealing with microRNAs, or miRNAs, or miRNAs, which are different from siRNAs, or siRNAs, great names. They have different pathways of biogenesis and different ways of working. But if I understand it correctly, the microRNAs typically target non-coding regions of messenger RNAs. They're produced in the cell. They're short, and they target non-coding regions and either inhibit translation or cause degradation of the transcript. Mm-hmm. Is that
That's correct.
Correct?
Yes, by base pairing with the non-coding regions. Right.
And how much they base pair depends on the mechanism of inhibition, right?
Right.
If there's good base pairing, now I've forgotten which one.
I think if there's good base pairing, you target those RNAs for degradation.
And if it's weaker, it inhibits translation?
Probably, but I don't think that's quite as well understood.
Yeah.
Because at first we talked about specificity of base pairing when we originally designed molecules to inhibit, and we thought that it was very important to be very stringent. And yet, these small RNAs work in many, many different ways. And it's interesting to see whether or not they are truly off target. That is, are they seeing more than a single class of RNA? Or is it this limited low-level interaction, which has some regulatory function that we don't quite understand entirely?
So the story begins here, and everyone jump in as you wish. These non-coding RNAs, the HSURS, boy, we have to figure out.
HSURS, how about that?
HSURS, okay, yeah, of Cimeri.
Sure, that works for me.
They don't have a role in transformation in vitro, but they said, well, maybe in the animal they're important, so they're worth studying. And they looked at the sequence and found some potential miRNA binding sites.
So it starts entirely with bioinformatics.
So the cell genome, the mammalian genome, encodes about 1,000 miRNAs, if I recall the number. So there's a whole database of those sequences, and you can search them with whatever sequence in your virus or whatever you have. So they did that, and they said, these HSURs have some homology to microRNAs.
Or anti-homology. The microRNAs could potentially base pair with the HSURs.
Right.
Right. And it's important to note that these are not, it's not a simple database search to find what a putative microRNA's target is or vice versa. So they've got these little RNAs, and you're looking at very short sequences, and it may matter if they can partially bind. There's an enormous amount of noise in these types of things, and you have to do a very careful statistical analysis and say, well, you know, maybe we're getting some activity with these targets.
And then you actually have to do the experiment and find out if they do interact.
Because, you have to go
because
into the lab.
Many of them don't. They are putative microRNAs or putative targets, and we have yet to be able to show that there's a real biologic effect.
Mm-hmm.
Right.
So in this case, they found complementarity with three cellular microRNAs. They're called miR-142, 3P, miR-27, and miR-16. And that's how these things are named, by number. I guess in the order that they were discovered or some such thing, but they all have numbers. I know miR-122 because it's required for hepatitis C replication, which is very interesting. So then they started to say, do these viral HSERS interact? And they do immunoprecipitation studies. They use antibodies to a protein called Argonaut. Now, why would they do that? What is Argonaut?
It's a processing protein.
Argonaut is part of the RISC complex. So at the very end of the whole miRNA pathway, you have an RNA protein complex that delivers the miRNA to the messenger RNA, and that complex contains Argonaut. So the idea would the miRNAs ought to come down with Argonaut. So the question is, if the miRNAs bind the HSER RNAs, might the HSER RNAs also come down in the same complex? So if you immunoprecipitate with an anti-Argo antibody, the question is, do the HSER RNAs come down? And indeed they do.
They did. Why do they call it Argonaut, by the way?
Jason, remember Jason and the Argonauts?
I do.
Well, they were passengers in space.
So this is a passenger. Is that?
It's a vehicle, really.
A vehicle.
Well, how do gene names arise?
Well, you know, the Sharon was a great one. I love that.
Best. Gene names arrives over a beer is what?
Yes.
So Sharon is where the original vectors named because Sharon was the boatman on the River Styx, right? He carried the dead over to the other side.
Right.
Was that hell over there?
It's the way to get to Hades.
Hades.
Think of it as a more exotic.
So Argonaut has similar origin. Okay, well, someone out there must know it. But they have great names, Dicer, Drosha, Argonaut, all these proteins involved in this RNA interference pathway. So, yeah, they co-immunoprecipitate. They cross-link, right?
Right. So the other immunoprecipitation that's relevant is that they immunoprecipitated with an antibody to SM protein.
Mm-hmm.
SM protein is a protein that's part of a lot of RNA protein complexes that are involved in splicing and stuff like that. And I think going into this, they knew that the HSER RNAs were part of a ribonucleoprotein complex containing SM. And so the question became, are these miRNAs also part of the same complex? And indeed, they come down in the same co-immunoprecipitation, implying that HSER and the miRNAs are in the same complex. They do cross-linking and stuff to back that up, and they also have a mutant herpes virus that doesn't have the HSER RNAs, and when you do the same immunoprecipitation with that, the miRNAs don't come down. I'll tell you, they did every damn control in the book.
Well it's a paper in science. Yeah,
it's just amazing.
It's not just a paper in science. It's a paper from an investigator, Joan Stites, who has a history of doing exquisite science.
Yeah, there are no holes in this.
And her involvement in the whole SM story along the way just shows they know what to do and they know how to do it. And the work is just exquisite.
So the key here, or one of the keys, is that in these cells that don't make HSERS, there's a difference in the level of miR-27, right?
Mm-hmm. Right.
Right.
So there's higher miR-27 when you don't have the HSER, which suggests that in some way the HSER is targeting the miR for degradation.
Mm-hmm.
And that's the story that emerges in the end. It's the only one of the three miR targets that whose abundance is different in cells that express these viral RNAs.
Well, the other thing is that they're always comparing the mutant and the wild type.
Right.
So you can just look and see the difference. You don't have to search through the data to try and figure out what's going on.
And the other two targets, the other miRs, the idea is that the base pairing with the HSER is not as good, so they are not, the theory is they're not as efficiently degraded as a consequence.
But you don't necessarily have to degrade the miRs to compromise their function.
That's
okay?
Right.
It could be that just binding them up will compromise their function, but they focused on the one where they could see the degradation.
That's right. In fact, they say that there may be some other mechanism for the other miRs besides degradation, and we have to figure that out.
And then also downstream from that, they also assayed a protein that they know is a target of miR-27.
Right.
and showed that that was regulated in an appropriate fashion depending on whether or not the miR-27 was around. Okay.
That's right. I think it's a protein called FOXO1.
Mm-hmm. A transcription factor.
Yep, a validated target. So we should say that not all these mirrors have validated targets, right? We don't know what they act on in say, normal uninfected cells. And so that's one of the validated ones. So that was a good addition as well. And there's one more thing.
So yeah, they did mutants of the H-SUR and showed that if they modified that, it would no longer cause the miR-27 to be degraded. So that it says that the base pairing's got to be right. And then they even made a modification of the H-SUR that should recognize another miRNA and showed that, yes, indeed, it would now pull that down with the anti-SM serum. I can't believe it. I mean, that's amazing.
Yeah, I wonder if this was all in the paper when they first submitted it.
I wouldn't be at all surprised.
Probably was, yeah.
I wouldn't be at all surprised because, as Saul points out, Dr. Stites is nothing if not rigorous.
So here's what we're left with. These SHURSs, wait a minute,
HSURs,
downregulate miR-27 and do something to the other mirs. And the question is why? What good is this to the virus? So the idea is maybe it has something to do with transformation, but we're a long way from understanding that.
I think so, but it's really a difficult problem to understand in the context of this virus. I believe that the genes for transformation map towards an end, but they've never actually been fully characterized. If I remember correctly, it's been a while since I've looked at it, but it could have something to do with just stability of the virus within the cell and providing an appropriate environment in which the virus can survive. It's going to exist as an episome.
Right, and since we don't know what all these mirror targets might be doing to the cell, the virus could be just fine-tuning its whole environment by targeting particular mirrors.
Yes, because remember, the targets are transcription proteins, which in turn will control the expression of many different genes.
Right. So now, my question seeing this is, okay, so herpes virus Cimeri figured out how to do this evolutionarily. How many other viruses have figured out this trick?
Well, we had a seminar here not long ago by Brian Cullen, who had a really what to me was an interesting observation about why different viruses might or might not want to encode microRNAs to start with, or as we see now, something that even manipulates microRNAs. And his suggestion was, among other things, that lytic viruses don't really care because they just go in and do their business and kill the cell and get out of there. But herpes viruses and other viruses that have a quiescent or latent cycle have to deal with the host over a long period of time and sort of integrate themselves into the system. And they have a lot more motivation to sort of tinker with the regulation in the host to create an appropriate environment. I really like that idea.
Yeah, but would you then argue that the virus will regulate expression of these SURs differently when it's lytic and when it's latent?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, because some viruses do both.
Could be.
Or is that not necessary?
And it depends on what it gets out of these H-SURs.
Yeah, and it also depends on the cell I assume that it's infecting. And that may be...
Are these made in a lytic cycle, these H-SURs?
So I don't know the answer to that.
I don't know the answer
for
to that.
For simplex, it's true, and I believe for cytomegalovirus, other herpes viruses, that's the case.
It might also it's just not worth the energy to suppress them during a lytic cycle because then you're operating more like a lytic virus that doesn't care what happens.
Yeah, it's pretty much a whole frontal assault during lytic infection, and you can probably bypass whatever happens to the cell as a result of expression of these small RNAs.
I wonder if cells make H-SUR-like molecules to regulate their own miRNA stuff.
Why not?
Sure.
Why not?
They learn from the pathogens that
and the other way around. It's absolutely a Star Wars thing, you know. It's amazing. Right.
And some viruses encode microRNAs.
Yes.
Right?
Yes. Well, the herpes viruses. Yes. I mean, yes. This virus itself, and I think encode. I don't know for sure. This is closely related to Kaposi's sarcoma virus, which I know encodes microRNAs. I think most of the herpes viruses do. So this probably encodes both microRNAs and these HSERs.
Yeah, and the microRNAs probably target host genes to modulate them further. So
absolutely
incredibly complicated. So I guess that's why your buddy there was excited about this paper, right?
Oh yeah, he was really excited. He's one of the discoverers of herpes virus microRNAs to start with. Okay, so this is right up his alley, and so this really got him excited. By the way, as long as we are naming names, I think it's important to point out that the first and second authors are Damian Cazala and Therese Yario, working in Dr. Stites's lab.
Yep.
Give the credit where credit is due.
They did the work. And we should also point out that the following paper in this journal, microRNA 33 and a host genes cooperate to control cholesterol homeostasis. So this stuff happens in uninfected cells. Normal homeostasis, they're implicated in cancer, dysregulation,
development.
These things are really important, and that's why a Nobel Prize was given for their discovery, although there's a lot of contention over who should have gotten that.
Isn't there always?
The first of these RNAs were discovered in C. elegans by Victor Ambros and colleagues, but they were thought to be a quirk of worms and not really appreciated until they were then found in other organisms.
Subsequently in flies and
plants.
Plants and you name it.
So Mello and Fire got it for their work in worms, right?
Right, I think that's
right. Yes.
Let's look it up just to be sure, because we don't want to have irate listeners telling us we don't know what we're talking about. If we don't, we're happy to hear that. Let's see.
2006 Nobel Prize in Physiology or Medicine.
He's so quick.
Fire and Mello.
Where did they find it in worms, right?
I believe so. Just double check that. Yes, I believe that's right.
Mello and Fire's 1998 Nature paper reported a potent gene silencing effect after injecting double-stranded RNA into C. elegans.
Yeah.
There you go.
Worms. Okay. Nice paper. Very nice. Check it out. Okay. Let's see. Let's go on to email. How about that?
Okay.
All right. Before we go on to email, however, I have a public service announcement from our friend Matt Freeman, who is of Matt's Bats, if you recall. He's a virologist at the University of Maryland. And he asked us to announce that down there at University of Maryland School of Medicine, they have a job opening for a virologist, a faculty position. So we'll give a link to this posting. They would like to have an investigator at the assistant, associate, or full professor level. Somebody who studies microbial pathogenesis, vaccine development, HIV biology, genome sciences, any of those things, multidisciplinary approaches, and someone who would like to interact with other investigators. So if you are a postdoc or a more senior person, you can apply for this job.
In the fine city of Baltimore.
Baltimore. So here on TWIV, we can announce jobs for you as well, if you wish. So let's do the first email is from Raphael, who writes, I'm a student in Dr. Isern's virology class at Florida Gulf Coast University. Can't wait for you to TWIV it up here in Florida, December 6th. Recently, I watched TWIV 66 reverse transcription in which you were talking about integration of HIV-1 into the host genome. At 49 minutes and 45 seconds, you mentioned that I do not know much about chromosomal structure with respect to why HIV-1 generally integrates into the exposed area on a nucleosome. It would make sense that HIV-1 would integrate into exposed areas on nucleosomes because, as I understand from genetics, the unwound, more exposed areas of DNA are being about to be actively transcribed, euchromatin, and otherwise the DNA is too tightly bound to the core histone proteins. Okay, that
makes sense.
That makes perfect sense. And in fact, from my textbook, there is a preference for integration into DNA sequences that are intrinsically bent or underwound as a consequence of being wrapped around a nucleosome. So that's absolutely correct. Second, I was wondering if you can do a TWIV on cancer-associated viruses in general, i.e. which ones have a more definitive association with causing cancer, some mechanisms of their viral replication cycle, receptor pathways affected, what exactly do antiviral, anti-cancer drugs target, etc. Sorry if this sounds vague, yet I am purposely wording it as such to give you leeway as to what you wish to speak about with respect to cancer-causing viruses. Can't wait to see your next TWIV, as well as see you live December 6th. We've always planned to do some TWIVs on those viruses, both the DNA and the RNA kind.
Sure.
So they'll be coming up.
I really want to do a papillomavirus TWIV.
Yep.
And get an appropriate guest to do that with us.
And Raphael says his career goal is to be a cardiopediatric diagnostician with a specialty in infectious diseases, autoimmune disorders.
That's pretty well worked out.
Wow.
It's always nice to know what you want to be.
That's okay. Yeah.
I'm still looking.
Next one is from James, also from Florida, Daytona Beach. I heard you ask Dick why DNA viruses need their host cells to be replicating for them to be able to duplicate their genome, and you guys concluded that the replication machinery is always off when the cells are not replicating, and thus the viruses can't access it. I remember we pondered over that in my virology class last year, and we concluded that when the cell is not dividing, the nuclear envelope is still intact, hence the virus can't access the replication machinery, which is usually inside the nucleus. On the other hand, the nuclear envelope is degraded in replicating cells, and hence the virus can access the replication machinery in the nucleus. I thought that could be another reason.
That's pretty much backwards, though, because most of these cells are replicating in fully nucleated. Most of these viruses are replicating in fully nucleated cells. And some of the issues relate to regulatory proteins that are sort of licensing proteins that control when an origin is available for DNA replication, things like germinin that go on and off in cell cycles and how viruses recruit them to these active sites of DNA replication.
But I thought there was some evidence in some retroviruses, however, that that was in support of this, that with some viruses they can replicate. I'm confused.
Yeah, so,
that's an integration phenomenon, though, more than a replication phenomenon.
Yeah, so most retroviruses require actively dividing cells to integrate
because
the nucleus is permeabilized, but HIV does not.
Correct.
Right.
Okay.
That's why you can use it for non-dividing cells. But for DNA viruses, that's not an issue, is what you're saying.
Not usually.
Yeah. So it's just that these licensing proteins are involved, yeah. Okay, James. There you go, from the expert. We have an email from Oystein, I guess, is how you would say it. My apologies for not having emailed you before. I am a 32-year-old physician currently undergoing training as a medical microbiologist in Norway. Since first discovering TWIV in the spring of 2009, I've been following every episode with enthusiasm. You're on my headphones when I'm walking, skiing, biking, driving, and especially when doing house and garden work.
Safety note, we should only be on one headphone at most when biking or driving. Please.
I saw someone driving with one earbud in this morning. That's okay, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, that's okay. That's legal. That's what I do.
The offside.
You ride a bike with one butt in, right?
That's true. That's what I do.
All right. He says, I listen because it's fun and because I enjoy the spirit of discovery and discussion that your show is full of. Almost as a side effect, I have also had lots of help from TWIV in my daily job, helping, amongst other things, to inform my views during the influenza pandemic, during my work with diagnosing hepatitis B and C, and lately when trying to make sense of the proposed link between XMRV and chronic fatigue syndrome. Then he points out the Low Alter article, which by now we have discussed. and I'm sure you will find occasion to comment on it. We have. I still retain a hopefully healthy skepticism about the CFS/XMRV/MLRV link, but have to admit the detective work and debate is intriguing. Okay, thanks, Oystein from Norway. All right, John sent in a contribution. Hey, Vincent and gang, my quick TWIV contribution. And I'll show this to you, Saul, here.
I recognize that guy.
He drew this on an iPad.
Okay.
Yeah, you've been immortalized.
I like not the bad. TWIV. I like the TWIV button. Yeah, it's me.
Not bad.
With the little viruses floating around. So, John, sorry, if you would do one of Rich and Alan and Dixon, we can put them all on the website.
You can replace the Beatles.
That's right. Thanks a lot, John. That's cool.
They're going to give us Beatles type money for this?
No. Sorry.
You'll get the 99 cents, Rich.
Yeah.
Next one is from Raihan. Greeting Twivers. I'm Raihan, a big TWIV fan in Singapore. You guys rock. I just want to share with you some local news regarding the release of genetically modified mosquitoes in some states in Malaysia, Singapore's neighbor, to combat dengue. I find this move really bold and potentially controversial, but I'll leave the judgment to you guys. So we have a article here from Channel News Asia, Malaysia mulls landmark trial of genetically modified anti-dengue mosquitoes.
Apparently, it wouldn't be as much of a landmark as people had thought a few months ago. I just blogged about this the other day. Most of the world was unaware that this experiment was done on Grand Cayman last year.
Right.
This company who's been working on these and developing these sterile mosquitoes, Aedes aegypti sterile mosquitoes.
Well, that's not new. Sterile mosquitoes have been released historically over years.
No, Saul. These are transgenic mosquitoes.
That part I understand.
Yeah, that part's... No, the sterile insect technique, I'm fully aware of that. One of my grandfather's colleagues developed that, Nippling, back in the 50s.
Nippling?
Yes, Ed Nippling. K-N-I-P-L-I-N-G.
Oh, okay.
So yeah. That's this very clever technique where you release sterile males into the population. They mate, the eggs don't hatch, and then you do this again year after year or season after season, and eventually you can eradicate the population. And that's why most people in the U.S. have not heard of screwworm fly anymore, because it's been eradicated.
And I think they did it also with fruit flies in California, I believe.
Yes, yeah, screwworm was the first one. So anyway, there's this idea of doing this with Aedes aegypti and possibly Anopheles at some point. And this company in the UK has been working on it. And
that's Oxitec, right?
Oxitec, yes.
Yeah.
It's a very cool technique. And I personally think that the benefits of it will probably outweigh the risks. But they've got a bit of a PR problem on their hands right now because they did this trial in Grand Cayman. They say that they told the local population they were doing it, but there's some debate about whether they explained that these were transgenic mosquitoes and not just, sterilized through conventional means.
Hmm.
And they did a couple of big releases, well, one small and one bigger release of genetically modified mosquitoes on Grand Cayman. Last year, and then they just finally got around to announcing it to the rest of the world just a couple of weeks ago.
How is the sterility induced by transgenesis?
They've inserted, it's fairly sophisticated. They've inserted a gene. I guess it renders them sterile in the sense that their offspring will die, but the issue... The way that they've done it is quite clever. I don't think we really have time to go into the details of it. But if you follow the links that I blogged, you can kind of get down to the rest of the story.
Okay. Yeah, they don't have any data in any of these.
You'd sure like to know how they reproduce.
Yeah, There's no information.
So the mosquitoes themselves aren't sterile, but they transfer
what they do, at least the experimental versions that I've read about before, and this is probably the basis of the ones that they're releasing now. These particular mosquitoes have an inducible gene that is induced when they're not given whatever.
Tetracycline,
I think, was used in the original. Is probably what they're still using. So if you give them, if you feed them a tetracycline blood meal, then they, you know, then they can hatch, and you can actually rear generations of them. And this tremendously simplifies the problem of developing these things, because you can breed them in captivity, and they breed just fine.
You just have to be careful about letting them out into chickens and. Cows in the United States who are fed massive amounts of antibiotics.
Yes. Potentially they can survive.
Great
point. Then you release them and you can also separate out the males from the females fairly easily this way by just turning off the tetracycline, and the females are not going to survive. You release these sterile males, or these males whose young are never going to hatch, and they go out and mate and die. And then you do it again the next season, and you know it's the same type of technique, but it's modernized to make the production of them much easier.
So the techniques that have been used up until now are they breeding techniques or
the techniques that were used up until now were you take your mosquitoes, you expose them to radiation or chemicals to sterilize them.
Okay.
And there's a real trick with this, because, of course, if you nuke them too much, they die. And if you don't nuke them enough, then they're not sterile. And there's a fine line in there where you also want to make sure that they're fit enough that they can compete for females.
So the genetic modification in this particular case is a significantly different twist on the whole sterility idea, in that it's potentially a propagatable trait. Except
that the trait itself is sterility, so it should not be propagatable. But that's why I say I personally think that the benefits of this, I mean, we're talking about Aedes aegypti. This thing spreads some very nasty viruses, as we've talked about on the show. So I think the benefit that you could get out of this could be enormous, and the risks of it spreading are pretty tiny, but there's no question that this is controversial.
Well, people, and part of the controversy is, as I understand it, is that people say, "Well, what's going to happen if you wipe out these mosquitoes? You know, what's the consequence?" But we've been doing that forever, just
right. Yes. And there's so many other species.
Oh, I have no problem with the idea of eradicating mosquitoes. I think that would be a huge step up. There's nothing. I don't think there's anything that depends on mosquitoes to survive.
No, malaria,
aren't they food?
Yeah, malaria. Okay, yes, they're, and these viruses.
They're food for bats, but bats have plenty of other insects.
Bats have plenty of other things to eat.
Right.
So if you took away all the mosquitoes, nobody would care.
I would care.
I think that we're treating this a little too lightly. I don't think we know.
We don't.
Most insects have a purpose.
But you have to look at it in the real world alternatives that would be used, and this is something that's missing from a lot of the genetically modified crop debate. It is not the case that we're choosing between genetically modified mosquitoes or absolutely no intervention. What we're choosing between is genetically modified mosquitoes or spraying insecticides willy-nilly all over the place,
which have much greater ramifications. They just noted recently that Northern California condors have thin eggshells, and DDT hasn't been used for years. And it turns out that one of their food sources is seals. Seals would probably die and get washed up, and they retain enough DDT in their fatty tissue that it's affected the shells of these animals, but not the ones in Southern California.
Right. Yeah, so in terms of what's actually going on, I don't think that we need to have a Save the Mosquitoes campaign. But the controversy that surrounds this is that once you release genetically modified mosquitoes, you can't take it back. These the reason we have these mosquitoes, the reason we have Asian tiger mosquitoes in the U.S., and the reason we have, Aedes aegypti on Grand Cayman in the first place is that these things can travel.
Right.
Well, they get travel by the wind. But the other end of that story, Alan, is that there's usually some degree of fitness that's missing in many of these animals, and the wild type survives.
Yes. Yeah, and as is apparent in this story, the phenotype is sterility, so that shouldn't survive. There are all sorts of reasons to believe why this shouldn't be a problem, but it's well known that there are a lot of people who are concerned about it, and even the international agencies like the WHO, who are very much in favor of eradicating the mosquitoes, have said, you need to take a cautious approach. So the problem is when Oxitec goes and does a trial like this and did not publicize it to the wider world in advance, it creates this appearance of impropriety. I'm not saying they did anything wrong. I'm saying that it gives a very bad impression that it was not that it was not announced more widely before they went in.
And maybe why they choose the sites of where they do these experiments.
Well, I'm sure Grand Cayman was not chosen at random. It is an island.
But isn't it a tourist destination?
It's a tourist destination and a financial a harbor of refuge, so to speak. But
and a great spot to dive.
Yes, supposed to have great scuba diving. I haven't been there yet.
So explain to me, if this phenotype won't spread, then how does it diminish the mosquito population?
Because the sterile males go out, they mate with females, the females mate, lay their eggs, and that brood eggs will never hatch.
So you have to put a lot of mosquitoes out there,
yes.
Right?
You do, but the thing is, you do it this year, and let's say you prevent several thousand broods from hatching.
Mm-hmm.
That's several thousand broods worth that you've decreased the population by. So next year you put the same population out there, and now they proportionally your sterile males are a larger proportion of the population.
Got it.
So you keep doing this year after year. It does have to be an ongoing campaign.
Yeah.
But eventually you get to a point where the only mosquitoes there are the ones you're releasing, and then you can stop.
So just give us a thought, everyone. What's the chance that this could ever happen in the U.S., that you would release modified mosquitoes? What do you think?
Is it a bad thing?
Who knows? I don't know. I just can't see. My feeling is I can't see us allowing this. I mean, we have issues with genetically modified foods, which, and so I don't think this could ever happen. That's just my view. So I'm just wondering.
I can see it.
It depends upon what happens with the infiltration of diseases like malaria and dengue.
You got a good. That's a good point.
In southern
U.S. Depends on what sort of a crisis you have. Okay.
I mean, if you've got a real issue, people can be persuaded.
Yeah. Ten years ago, would people have submitted to a crotch groping to get onto an airplane? If you've got an issue that people see as compelling, then it'll override a lot of these concerns.
Right. It's like the same as the vaccine arguments that we've been having. One of the problems with keeping a vaccine coverage up is that the population has very little experience with how nasty these diseases can actually be.
Yeah, the population needs to suffer for there to be a positive response. It's unfortunate, but it seems to be the easiest way that we can educate.
Well, we had yellow fever at a time as far north as Philadelphia in this.
Yeah, they used to have to evacuate Philadelphia every summer.
So I guess that was controlled by DDT, right?
No, was controlled by window screens and air conditioning.
So, there are other ways to control. And we do have a yellow fever vaccine that's quite effective.
Right, and the reason we don't worry about these diseases much in this country is that we've developed the infrastructure in a way that people just aren't exposed to the mosquitoes enough to sustain transmission.
Right.
So if you look at, you can even look at places like the Texas-Mexico border, and you see vastly higher rates of mosquito-borne disease on the Mexico side than on the Texas side, and they've got the same climate, they've got the same environment. The difference is that people in South Texas are charging from an air-conditioned car into an air-conditioned mall and into their air-conditioned houses, whereas people in Mexico are much more likely to be, to be exposed to the outside air more often and get bitten more often.
I thought it was the border.
No, the fences don't keep them out.
No, the mosquitoes can go?
The mosquitoes, they don't care about the border. Okay.
But
right.
If you think about it, the simplest way of decreasing malaria is to put these bed nets in.
Yeah, sure.
And right, it's the same idea. I mean,
exactly.
We installed window screens, and if people have houses that are tight enough for window screens, you give these insecticide-soaked bed nets. But in places where there are logistical barriers to that, it may make sense to try and wipe out the mosquitoes.
Yeah. The low-tech solutions are often very effective.
Yes. Yes, the greatest public health technology ever invented was the toilet.
That's right.
Depends on where it flushes.
True. But at least the toilet gets it going in the right direction.
Well, I also think vaccines play a role here, and for dengue, it's a little difficult, but we're working on it, and perhaps a combination of the two will work one day. But many people are working on dengue vaccines. In fact, at this moment, there is a dengue meeting going on in Cancun, I understand.
Appropriate place.
And there are a number of reports on progress on vaccines, so we'll see where that heads. Anyway, Raihan, thank you
for a lively discussion.
Stimulating yes. that. And Raihan closes by saying, Alan, ever thought of writing a joke book?
Nah, there's no money in it.
Okay. Science comedy, maybe.
Yes.
All right, let's do one more. This one is from Stephen, pertaining to your interview with Dr. Ela Singh on TWIV94. I wanted to clarify some language you and a guest used that adds to the confusion about chronic fatigue syndrome. During the broadcast, you refer to CFS in shorthand as chronic fatigue. Since you are a scientist that appreciates precision, I will point out that this characterization of CFS is incorrect because the phrase refers to two general distinct descriptions of different things. Chronic fatigue, used by itself in a medical context, refers to idiopathic chronic fatigue, fatigue that cannot be explained using any clinic definition of disease or disorder. Chronic fatigue is also generally used by the patient population as a symptom of any physiological human dysfunction. As you dive into the morass that is CFS, I can sense through your broadcasts that you are becoming aware of the historical high-level problems related to the disease, specifically the taxonomy and clinical definition of CFS. The CDC made a mess of things by choosing such a nonsensical name as CFS, perhaps betraying an institutional culture dismissive of the disease or not, but it did serve to confuse researchers for a generation and set back the entire field up to this very day. By the way, your shows are a great public service. Okay. I guess occasionally we do say chronic fatigue, but we do mean CFS. And I understand it should be CFS/ME, mild chicken
encephalitis. Well, or fibromyalgia, or it's... The issue is you need a name for the condition, and this one is controversial, but it's also easy to say CFS.
So perhaps we
mean no offense by choosing that particular name. It is used in a lot of the research papers still.
Perhaps when we have an etiology, the name will change, right?
Yes, it could very well.
So perhaps we will see that in the coming year.
Right.
All right, let's go on to a few picks of the week, and let us start with Rich Condit.
All right, so this is mildly redundant of something we did just a couple of episodes ago, but it was this is another feed from my wife, backed up by a redundant feed from Dr. McFadden. It's a New York Times article called "Where Cinema and Biology Meet." A couple of twibs ago, we highlighted a science animation company that is also highlighted in this article, but this article is broader. It talks about science animation generally and talks about several different companies that are making animations of scientific topics of one sort or another, and it's got a little video in it as well that you can play. It's about 6 minutes long that shows some of the animations from various of these different companies. So it was a nice summary of the whole field rather than focusing simply on one animator. So this is becoming a real business, and I'll be very interested to see where this goes. We may see a lot of very cool visualizations coming from a number of different
companies. It's a great teaching tool. I spent yesterday afternoon looking at a number of those animations in the hopes of incorporating them in some of the lectures that I give, and I can't wait to use them.
The video is great because it interviews a woman who is a scientist who went away to an animator's school to learn how to do the animations. She said all of her buddies at the school were these young computer hotshots that want to get careers at Pixar and stuff like that. You know, what she wants to do is animate the insides of the cell. So she was a little bit of an outsider in the group, and it was an interesting group.
That's cool. I like to hear what Peter Walter says. He says, some animations are clearly more Hollywood than useful display. It can become hard to distinguish between what is data and what is fantasy.
Well, that's important. You know, that's going to be important in all of this.
The other
that's
thing
why
is that
you need
some
scientists
of them,
going into this field.
Right. And the other thing is that some of them move so quickly that you would not be able to use them to explain a process. So even though they are reiterative loops, you can't use those as good teaching tools because you want to discuss what molecules are present and what activities are occurring, and if it's just whizzing by, all you're going to do is obfuscate the lesson.
Yeah, well, you need them in some sort of format where you can, you know, use the slide to stop them or show them, slow them down, and control the animation yourself. Very cool.
This is useful to see some of the names behind this.
Mm-hmm.
If there is a Steven Spielberg of molecular animation, it is Drew Berry, a cell biologist in Australia. Cool. Thomas Kirchhausen from Harvard says, animations are a way to glue all the information together. I like them, but they obviously take some liberties, as we discussed last time. But anyway, it's cool.
Yeah.
Thank you very much. Alan.
Oh, my pick of the week is one of these iDevice apps, used to be called an iPhone app, but now you can get all these different sorts of platforms. I have the iPod Touch. This one is from QIAGEN, maker of the very commonly used reagents and supplies that everybody has in their labs. It's a really handy tool. I discovered it because they sent a press release about it, and I figured, well, I'm not in the lab anymore, but I'll take a look at this thing. Of course, they have it to some extent as a conduit for advertising their products. There's a section of videos on it, which are techniques, all of them highlighting particular products from the company. Those could be kind of handy, but what's really cool to me is it comes with this whole set of calculators for different things. You've got physical units, chemical units, molecular biology calculators. If you want to calculate, you're given oligos at a particular nanomolar concentration or picomolar concentration, and you need that in micrograms, it'll do that calculation for you. You can convert all sorts of physical units, temperature, acceleration, mass. And then it has a bunch of molecular biology calculators, molarity of your protein and things like that. And then it also has a whole set of recipes for different buffers, commonly used buffers and media. So you need to mix up a quick batch.
I'm downloading a sucker right now.
I was just going to say, Rich is downloading it.
I'm sorry I didn't see it earlier and have a chance to play with it, but it sounds great.
Yeah, that's one reason I picked it. I thought, oh, Rich will be into this.
Those are the tools you want everybody in your lab to have, but you really want to make sure that they understand how to do those calculations without the tool. It's like a kit. A kit is great until you have to troubleshoot it.
Right.
I don't know if they use this, so they're not going to know the basis, sadly, but this will help. But they have to have an iPhone or iPad or something, iPod Touch, to do this. They will probably make this for Android, too, I would guess.
I would expect so, yes.
Eventually. Cool. That's neat. I have an iPad app, which I'll pick next time. That's just reminded me of that.
Here we go. Calculators. I'm all set. Ooh, goody. This is great.
Well, yeah, I'm not even in the lab anymore. Looking at this thing, I thought, I'm probably going to keep this just for things like the physical units, you know?
Whoa, look at this. Centrifugations. I can put in a radius and the rotations, and it'll give me keys out the other end. Far out.
No more nomograms.
That's right.
Right. All right.
Well, my pick is a website called Ask a Biologist. I don't know if you've ever seen it, but I just stumbled across this. There's an article in PLOS One about it this past few weeks. And this is a project of Arizona State University, funded by a variety of places like the National Science Foundation. And basically, you send in a question, and they farm it off to an expert, and you get an answer. So you can anything in biology you can do. But they also have resources online here. They have videos, podcasts, images, links, and so forth. So a good resource, I think, for teachers, maybe for students looking for answers to specific questions, perhaps for an exam or a project. No, I didn't say that. But I think an interesting way to crowdsource information. They use experts in the field, not just anyone, sort of not like Wikipedia. These are experts in specific fields, and you can get answers to the question. So I think it's a great idea.
This is cool.
Maybe we should send them a virology question.
Sure.
What's the biggest virus?
I'm just looking at the ugly bug contest. This is fun stuff.
Pictures of bugs, yeah.
Yeah.
You can vote for your ugliest bug. So there's a place for this. I think that's pretty cool. Ask a biologist.
Where's the ugly bug contest?
Upper right.
All right.
Teacher toolbox. Anyway, check it out. It's cool.
Right.
All right, that'll do it for another TWIV. A few things in wrapping up here. If you go to our website, twiv.tv, I've started to add the comments from iTunes. Now, over at iTunes, you know, we always ask people to go over there and subscribe to TWIV and put some comments in. That keeps us on the front page of the Medicine Podcast Directory at iTunes. So there are now over 140 comments there, and some of them are really wonderful. And I thought I would start copying them over to TWIV. So there's a tab up on the webpage where you can see those. It's called Kudos. The last one is from a guy who is a mailman who listens to TWIV while he delivers letters. It's pretty funny. You should check it out.
Excellent.
And a bunch of other good ones.
The reach of this show is just astounding.
Yeah, we
educating
get,
the world.
Everyone, we get professors down to, well, not down to, across.
Over to.
Across
yeah.
to truck drivers and painters. It's great. So that's one thing. Another thing is I started a fan page on Facebook, facebook.com/thisweekinvirology, all one word. We already have lots of fans there. So check that out. And, of course, there's a lot of ways to listen to TWIV at iTunes, the Zune Marketplace, and also using the Microbe World app where you can stream the episodes to your iPhone or iPad. Check it out at microbeworld.org. And, of course, you can always go to twiv.tv. Download, play the episodes, and read the show notes. Your questions and comments should go to twiv@twiv.tv. Thank you, Alan Dove, who you can find at alandove.com.
Always a pleasure.
You can see his latest post about this mosquito story that we just talked about. Hadn't seen that. Just went up yesterday.
Yep.
There you go. Rich Condit. Hey, Rich, how did those gators do last week?
Not well at all. We're not talking about it.
Okay, sorry.
It's okay. We'll come back sometime in the future.
Good to see you again.
Good to be here.
Saul Silverstein is right next to me here at Columbia. Welcome back.
Why, thank you.
Good to have you. Always fun. Don't you like doing this?
I love doing
this. It's great. I'm Vincent Bracaniello. I'm at virology.ws. You've been listening to This Week in Virology. Thanks for joining us. We'll be back next week. Another TWIV is viral.